Good morning. If we have not met, I'm Audrey. I'm a service leader here, and other than sign-up sheets, part of my responsibility is to do this from time to time. So we're going to be jumping into Judges 8, and if you're like, oh man, but we didn't do Judges 7 last week, you're correct. So Pat actually did that about 2 weeks ago, so I'm going to jog your memory here. In Judges chapter 7, just a few bullet points. God asks Gideon to reduce his army to 300 men, which is terrifying if you are going into war. Then they, being these 300 men, overtake the Midianites using trumpets and empty jars. If it sounds wild, it was absolutely wild. I wish we could have, like, put Pat's, I almost said one of my kids' names. Oh, man. We're off to a great start. If we could have, like, reduced that down to, like, a YouTube short, because YouTube shorts are everything now, right? And then Gideon is obedient and worships God. So in a nutshell, this is where we were in Judges 7. This might be slight hyperbole, but also I realized on the way here, there's some extra meaning in the fact that they're on Pride Rock, right? So if you don't get that for where we're going, just keep that in the back of your mind. They are on Pride Rock. And this might be a spoiler. It might not, because we're in Judges. There are no surprises. This is where we're going today. So, buckle up. Chapter 8 starts with this really weird complaint. The men of Ephraim said to him, and here the hymn is Gideon, "What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" They accused him fiercely. And he, Gideon, said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. And this already sounds kind of odd, because Gideon from chapter 7 would have been like, oh, well, this is what God had done. And here we have Gideon saying, I've really done nothing. It was really nothing. He kind of strokes their ego, because they were known for military strength. He's like, oh, what I did, it was small potatoes in comparison. But okay, Gideon, we'll follow along. We'll ride this roller coaster with you. And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over. Okay, so if we take like a quick aside, I really struggle with Old Testament stories, and it's, you know, a context shift. History was absolutely my worst. I took college history, and the only reason I passed was because of texting. There was only like 8 of us in the class, and so we were all spread out through the class, and we kind of took it as a group effort. But I passed. History is not my thing. And then add in geography. So if you're somebody who typically glazes over this, you can glaze over this. But we're going to look at the map anyways. And I circled where we are, because we're kind of like toward the bottom. Gideon's going to cross over the Jordan, and then we're going to visit Succoth and Penuel, and then Gideon, because you just log this away for later, along with Pride Rock, Gideon is going to take that orange arrow. And if you need to glaze over that, have at it. He and the 300 men who are with him, exhausted, yet pursuing. And he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna." You can pronounce those however you would like. That's how we're going to pronounce them today. "The kings of Midian and the officials of Succoth said, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army?'" So food is scarce, and Gideon is asking these people, who likely would have been allies, "Hey, can you help feed us?" And they do not respond like allies would be expected to respond. They're like, "Have you already completed your mission? Because otherwise, sorry, can't help you." And why would they do this? Maybe they're afraid that Gideon isn't going to actually complete the mission, and then they'll be on the receiving end of some pretty harsh consequences. Either way, the men of Succoth, whether they were good friends, besties or not, like, "No, we can't help you." So Gideon, we're going to see how he responds. And we're still getting to know Gideon of chapter 8, not chapter 7. And Gideon said, "Well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. And he said to the men of Penuel, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. We have yet to see any mention from Gideon about God. So as best as we can tell, Gideon has decided that he is going to be on his own revenge train. Join me, or when I come back, you will be sorry that you did not join me. And he gets pretty specific here. So far we have Succoth and Penuel, and they're not going to help him. Gideon has made some pretty big promises of revenge. Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, that's where that orange arrow went to, with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. That was from chapter 7. And Gideon went up by the way of tent dwellers, he took a back route, east of Noba and Jogbaha, and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. They weren't expecting some sneak attack. I believe it was also in the night, which adds to the sneak attack piece. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled. And he, Gideon, pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. So despite the fact that his army of 300 is still very hungry, he has the kings of Midian. Despite the fact that he was also still really small and compared to the 15,000 men that still were part of the Midian army. And how could Gideon do that? Because we saw Gideon in chapter 7. He was very confident because God was behind him. He was being very obedient. And we're not quite seeing this here. Gideon is still, though, riding this train of confidence of, I can do on any of it. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the scent of Aris, and he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for the officials and elders of Succoth 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted? So he is bringing back up, hey, we came and we had this conversation, and I have the guys now. Do you remember that you taunted me? Again, this does not sound at all like Gideon from chapter 7 at all. He is on this war path of vengeance for himself. We still have no mention of God or Gideon being obedient to him. So here are the guys that I captured. Do you remember taunting me when I asked for bread? And so he took the elders of the city, and he makes good on his promise. He took the thorn of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Gideon is riding this confidence train all the way to the bank. He has made good on these promises so far. Then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, where are the men you killed at Tabor? They answered, as you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king. And he, Gideon, said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother, as the Lord lives. If you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. So if we pause for a second about how I struggle with the Old Testament stories sometimes, it seems like there's some information missing here that probably would have made more sense when this originally happened. But we can still infer that Gideon had some brothers that Zeba and Zalmunna at some point killed. And Gideon, being on his revenge train that he is, has decided he is going to avenge their names. So he is bringing this up. He's making his case. If you've ever had to make a case to somebody, you start with your strongest case, and then you just keep throwing stuff out. And another thing. Or maybe with your boss, or maybe you shouldn't do that. But he's bringing up everything that he can think of. You killed my brothers. And so if you hadn't, I would spare you. So he said to Jether, Gideon said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a young man. And this is also one of those cultural things that you kind of have to look into. If a young man were to slay somebody like a king, that was kind of like being slapped with the backside of a hand. This was more insult on injury. And so Gideon is trying to put his firstborn son up to this. But the boy is afraid because he's still a young man. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and fall upon us, For as the man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. So if he couldn't insult them in one way or another, he is going to take every bit. He is not leaving any crumbs here at all. The men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." Gideon said to them, and this is where we're finally seeing Gideon that we wanted to rally behind in chapter 7. Gideon finally, it seems like he's right on the straight and narrow again. He says, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Right, so that first picture of the Lion King, it seems like we're back there again. Gideon, he's redeemed himself. He's back on the straight and narrow. "No, I'm not going to set up some dynasty to rule over you. Absolutely not. Only the Lord will rule over you." He's absolutely saying the right thing. But we're about to have whiplash. Because immediately following what Gideon says here, Gideon makes a request. And these people were just asking him to rule over them, so it should be a shoo-in that whatever he asks, he should know that they're going to oblige. Gideon says, "Let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And again, reasons why the Old Testament is hard for me to go through personally sometimes. They throw in some words here that don't make sense to me. Spoil? Like, all I can think about is like the veggies rotting in the drawer of my fridge. What in the world? And then we bring in Ishmaelites? It's hard enough when people's names change and now you're bringing in a whole different people that I have to figure out who they are so that we don't glaze over it further. Spoil, goods stolen or taken forcibly from a person or place, which also, if you are not familiar with like war tactics and what happens there, I would not expect you to be up to date on that. And Ishmaelites originally referred to another nomadic tribe, like a specific people, but did take on a broader usage. And here it's talking about the Midianites. So that does help us understand the context here a little bit more. But in the big picture, Gideon is making this request that he knows is going to get filled. And he says, "Give me the earrings that we took." And so, of course, they answered, "We will willingly give them." And they spread a cloak, and every man threw in it the earrings of his spoil. And the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. That's like roughly 42 pounds. So like my earrings, I don't even know if they would be an ounce. 42 pounds of gold. And Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah. And Israel whored after it there. And it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. And the land had rest for 40 years in the day of Gideon. And if we go back to defining some words that I don't use every day, ephod, a fancy vest type thing that a priest would have worn. Except here, it doesn't sound like anybody's wearing it. Gideon made this ephod to be an idol, and put it on display like an idol. And all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. Jerubbaal and the son of Joash went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine who was in Shechem also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. That's foreshadowing for where we go next week. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, at Ophrah of the Abizarites. As soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done in Israel. And so if you can stop and put yourself in the story, all their enemies that were all around them are no longer their enemies. They're not there anymore. They had been subdued. They had been delivered. God had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And I have to think that your daily life looks a little bit different. And nonetheless, Israel did not remember the Lord their God. They are still living on Pride Rock in the darkness and really by their own choosing. So this is a tough story. And I guess really if Judges is not yet feeling heavy for you, we still have a ways to go. And it's easy for me to get caught up in the doom and gloom about, wow, I can see myself in that story in so many ways. Things that I feel like I'm just circling the drain on. And I think I'm going to make the right choice. But then just like Gideon, he's having all this success and he forgets God. I get stuck in that so often. But what helps is when I look at scripture and I first ask, what does this tell me about God? When I look for God in the story first, I rightfully put myself where I belong. So what does this story tell us about God? This is hard because God is barely mentioned in this story. And maybe that says something on its own. But if we also glean back to chapter 7, we do see a few things. God uses broken people who will get it wrong. God was not at all surprised that Gideon was obedient in some ways and then absolutely disobedient in other ways and totally forgot him. God wasn't surprised. And still, God calls Gideon to do that. Also, we see that God is faithful, both in blessing and consequence. What Gideon did doesn't change God's faithfulness. God still had his plan. God was still in power. God was still in control, despite Gideon's actions after being so obedient and then not. But also when we look at scripture, we do look for how it informs how we live out our faith. And so I kind of switched up Pastor Kyle's so what, because and now what? What do I do with this? Because I can't just read a story like this and look at God and then just move forward unchanged. So I have a question. We'll remind ourselves that the man who led them out of oppression also drew them back into idolatry. Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in a city in Ophrah, and all Israel prostituted themselves after that. There. That's the tragedy that we see in the story. And when we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, it said so well, if you think that you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Gideon was living in such success. Things were going so well for him. And then it was like he took the wheel and he said, this is easy. I got this from here. I'll just keep driving. He totally left God out of the picture. And then we see where he fell. He was such an easy target. It was so easy for him to fall to spiritual defeat once he took the wheel back. So that question, what's going well for you right now? And this isn't a trick question. And I don't want you to overthink it because some of us will say, but it's not going as well as it could be, whatever the thing you're thinking. Or, well, I guess this is going well because it's going better than somebody else at work. Everybody has something that's going well for them. For the practice of this practice, I don't want you to overthink it. And I'm going to make this awkward because I want you to write it down. And if you don't have paper in front of you, you probably have a phone. I didn't actually bring mine. I was actually going to text my small group. I don't have my phone. I'll have to find paper, man. All right, so we are going to all wait awkwardly while you write something down or text a friend. What is going well for you? If you're feeling brave, text your small group. You can put it in the memo spot of your phone, wherever you need to put it so that you remember. I found Post-its. Jeopardy music would have been helpful here, huh? All right, so I'm sure that you've not overthought this thing at all. You wrote something down, you text somebody, what have you. Are you a fall risk? So you have blind spots in your car, and they are blind spots because they are blind spots. They are appropriately named as such. And when you pull up to an intersection, you do the bob and weave thing to make sure that there's not a car in your blind spot. So are you a fall risk? What's in your blind spot right now about the thing that's going well? In the thing that's going well, are you still acknowledging God in it? Are you susceptible to kind of forgetting because it's on autopilot? And this isn't something that's meant to feel like some huge guilt, shame in your gut or your chest, because it happens. There are accidents that happen because there was a car in the blind spot and we thought we checked. So we're doing our due diligence right now. The thing that's going well, we're going to thank God for it, and we are going to acknowledge God in it. And this is just the first time you're going to do this week. And whenever you remember it this week, whenever you're driving, if you're above 16 and licensed to do so, every time you check your blind spot, you are now going to think, oh, that thing that's going well, I will not let that be in my blind spot. I am going to thank God for that. I'm going to be reminded that I am actually not in the driver's seat, and I want God to be in the driver's seat. So hold on to that thing, and we're going to pray. God, we thank you so much that we get to do this together. And this thing that we have that we know is going well, we remember that you are the reason. Because God, when we ask you to be the Lord of our life, you become the reason for all the things. This is going well not because of me and my own strength. And help me to remember that often. I thank you so much for this thing that's going well. And I'm going to be diligent in praying about it and thanking you just as diligent as I was when this thing was not going well. Because you are still just as important and just as worthy. And I'm just as thankful and grateful for your place in my life, for the direction that you give me, for the provision that you have put in front of me. So help me to not forget. Help me to keep this out of my blind spot so that I don't fall. And even when I mess up and I might fall, you'll still be there waiting to help me back up. But God, for now, I'm reminding myself that you are actually at the driver's seat. And there's nothing better than that. Thank you for your steadfast love and that you abide in us. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.